also apparently expand into, like, other fey creatures, like elves and pixies and whatnot.
That shouldn't surprise me. What was the last one you said?
Elves and pixies will pop up.
Oh, will pop up. I thought you said, and Popeye. And I
was like, you know, Popeye. He's the muscle fey.
That's how they defeat Christoph Waltz at the end. They call him Popeye the Sailor Man. The music starts playing. He squeezes a can of spinach into his pipe, sucks it down.
Yeah.
Who's hosting? Do I have to host?
You're hosting.
Too much iron! You're not feeling it.
Your idea. You host.
Episode of Why Did We Watch This, the podcast where three friends sit down, watch a troubled movie, have a nice drink, talk about what was good, what was bad, and how we could all do it better. I am your host for this week, Lee. Dad! Mom! No! Delahanty.
I'm Chris Suckhole Ravel.
And I'm Brendan, destined to be average Drishler.
Oh
and
my gosh.
If you could not tell from those nicknames, we've just finished watching The Portable Door.
The Portable Door.
2023.
Now,
here's the big question.
What's
can
the
you
big
say
question
the title
here?
With the accent that communicates, I'm an Australian trying to play British?
Mate, it's The Portable Door, is it? Working for J. Wellington, JWLs.
Let's throw back our Fosters together.
Yes. Anyway, we got... This movie
right.
features Patrick Gibson,
yes.
Sophie Wilde, Miranda Otto, Rachel House. We got, in the celeb side, we got Samuel and Christoph Waltz.
Right. Probably the biggest names.
Yeah.
They're the lowest on the list, interestingly enough.
I guess, is it like, do they have the and that's why they're lowest on the list or something?
I'm
maybe?
Not sure.
And with.
Reading from Wikipedia. They're on the top of the poster, but they're on the end of this list.
And
Directed by Jeffrey Walker.
Yes.
I believe it's also Jessica DeGaux was
Jessica DeGaux.
Yeah,
I don't know who that woman is.
Yeah, I don't know who Jeffrey Walker is. Apparently he is Australian, because this movie, of course, was filmed in Australia despite taking place in England and being based on an English book. It is obviously set in England, but there's a lot of Aussie actors in
with
this
movie.
With
the aid of the Jim Henson Company.
With the aid of the Jim Henson Company doing some special effects.
Feeling somewhat misused.
Anyway, to get through this movie, we obviously needed to have a nice little drink. What did we drink this time?
So the drink that we made for this was called the Potable Door. It was 2 ounces of gin, a half an ounce of lime juice, a quarter ounce of honey, rhubarb bitters, sparkling water, strawberries, and basil. You cut the strawberries and basil leaves into small pieces and add to a cocktail shaker with honey and lime juice. You muddle it until everything's nice and combined. Add the gin, bitters, and ice to the shaker and shake until chilled. Strain into a glass and top with sparkling water.
I really liked it. I think it's a very nice, light, springy drink.
Yeah, we were hoping for something more springy today. It's
weather-wise,
overcast and gray and unpleasant.
And on another day, it would have been.
Yeah, I know. That's true. I wish it had been a little more strawberry-forward. I probably could have thrown in a few more strawberries in there, I think. I definitely felt the basil more than I think I felt the strawberry, but that was just me.
I think that the smell of basil in this is a little strong for me,
mm-hmm.
but the taste is fine.
Yeah.
I just sort of have to, like, not breathe in the basil.
I mean, basil in excess can taste a bit like licorice, which is
true.
A bit of a plot point in this movie.
I had debated about using like anise or something, but I likewise hate the taste of licorice, so I did not want to throw it in there. But like maybe if I had made a basil honey simple or something as the sweetener instead of just like throwing in basil and honey, it might have been a little more subtle or something.
I think putting
maybe in a strawberry basil syrup.
Yeah.
I think putting in the rhubarb bitters was a good call.
Yes,
I agree.
It was a nice little plus to it.
Strawberry and rhubarb, a classic combo.
That's right. Yeah.
Overall, a nice little refreshment.
Yeah, a nice little... It was because of all the sparkling water, too. It's a very sort of, like, light and easy drink to drink, you know?
Nice,
it's not,
nice
like, heavy.
Color.
I'm still
drinking mine, because I had coffee earlier.
Yes, you did.
And I needed some space between that and alcohol.
I get that.
But yeah, it's a nice little, like, pinkish drink. My thoughts, really, for this one are basically just, like, oh, basil, honey, strawberry. Those are all, like, pretty British flavors, traditional, like... ingredients used in British
it's like we're strolling in the English countryside.
That's right, like we just opened our portable door and randomly appeared, and Little Bitty Pretty Ones started playing.
And we said, the Cotswolds!
Yep.
Well, Brendan, why don't you explain to me what the fuck happens in this
tell
movie?
Tell us all about it.
Let me turn to my good friends, raisingchildren.net.au, the Australian parenting website.
Story.
Refreshingly free of sex and violence.
No boomerang assaults in this picture, mate.
After a series of unfortunate events, Paul Carpenter, Patrick Gibson, misses a job interview at a coffee shop. He finds himself in a mysterious company being interviewed by a panel of board members for a job he knows nothing about. When Paul notices a map in the wallpaper of the boardroom, the interview ends abruptly and he's convinced that he won't get this desperately needed job. Much to his surprise, Paul is hired and asked to report to the office of J.W. Wells & Co. the next morning. At J.W. Wells & Co., Paul finds himself sharing an office with Sophie Wilde, a fast-tracked overachiever who wants nothing to do with him and who knows nothing about her job either. Before long, CEO Humphrey Wells, Christoph Waltz, and his partner Dennis Tanner, Sam Neill, secretly task Paul with the job of finding a missing portable door that doesn't want to be found. Paul searches everywhere for the door, and in the process he discovers that the company and its employees aren't what they seem to be. When Paul finally locates the door, he and Sophie use it for their own purposes, traveling the world, until the door takes Paul to a place he was not meant to see. Here, Paul hears firsthand about Humphrey's evil plot to steal souls. Paul sees how Sophie has been used as a guinea pig in this plot, but before they can reclaim Sophie's soul, Paul and Sophie are discovered and trapped in a realm of doors. The Nether. Here they encounter Humphrey's missing father, also played by Christoph Waltz, who disappeared without a trace many years before. Working together, they realize that if they can get Humphrey's soul to the Bank of the Dead, they'll be able to free Sophie and control Humphrey. But will any of the doors they're trapped behind ever let them out? So that's where it stops. Going off of that, we can also say that Paul finds a way out when they're trapped in this room of doors. It seems that he just sort of feels something, as he has throughout the movie demonstrated the ability to be able to find things.
As a diviner.
Right, which is why he's been tasked to find the door. He hovers over a door, it starts to make this little electrical noise that you sometimes hear when he finds things, and it opens and lets them out right outside the company. And at the time, it's just sort of presented as like, oh, he found the way out. So they all, Father Christoph Waltz, Sophie, and what the fuck's his name, Paul, run back into the company to try and get Humphrey's soul off of him. There is a battle going on between Humphrey and his dad. Sophie uses her telekinetic abilities to summon the other board members, who this synopsis sort of briefly touched upon, but there are other people in the job interview who kind of matter more, like Rachel House is one of them. She's sort of like an older woman. There's Miranda Otto as a countess.
That's all they call her, is the countess.
Right. I think she has an actual name, but she is just the countess. And she she basically has been working with Sophie throughout the movie, kind of
specifically on creating these coincidences.
Right. Like, her whole thing is sort of like creating coincidences for people who it seems like are paying for them. It seems like families are paying for them. And it's sort of like, oh, if I use magic and make a stone collapse at this right moment in time, this guy will fall into a fountain, a girl will notice him, and the two of them will have their meet cute. And then, like, that's what the guy's family was paying
especially
for.
Especially if she notices it while she's reading a specific
while she's reading
of
Ian McEwan's Atonement, yes. Sophie has some sort of like telekinetic abilities, which she uses to summon the other board members. There's Rachel House. Telepathic, not telekinetic. And also there is a fellow named Casimir who seems to be able to appear in dreams.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what he does. Who all three of those guys seem kind of on the level, like kind of decent people, as opposed to Christoph Waltz and his lackey Samuel, who are a little more overtly malicious. They summon them to this place. It turns out also that goblins are heavily involved in this story as well.
Well, Miranda Otto mentions it during the first
right. Miranda,
job
she keeps. We see it periodically that they're getting little tubes, like those pneumatic tubes,
getting like tossed up
right from banks that keep getting tossed out of like drains or holes in the ground. And Miranda Otto just says, "Oh, they're coming from goblins. Goblins are obsessed with humans. They love watching them, and we use that to sort of like, you know, as like the backbone of our company, basically."
Yeah. It's not enough information.
No, there's not enough information about goblins, period. Goblins can also, I guess, shapeshift, apparently, in this movie.
Yep.
And Christoph Waltz can also turn them into office supplies.
Yeah, he has some kind of spell where he turns them into things like staplers or
right,
calculators.
Which is strange, but anyway. So there are goblins, which is something that they discover at this point. And Sam Neill is also a goblin who can shapeshift to be a human at times, because shapeshifting is apparently something goblins can do in this world, which is also not really gone into too much. While this battle is going on between all of them, it looks like baby Christoph Waltz has the upper hand, and he's going to get the soul, which is also not mentioned in the synopsis. So when adult. Yeah, yeah, when yeah. Christoph Waltz Sr. saw Christoph Waltz Jr. as a baby, he was like, oh, this kid's in trouble. This kid's going to be no good. So when he was young, he was like, hey, my son, Christoph Waltz Jr., sign a contract giving your soul over to me that says, like, if you choose to be evil, I will have ownership of your soul basically, for all eternity. Yeah. And for whatever reason, if you betray me. And for whatever reason, he doesn't really do anything with this.
He holds on to it.
Right, which it seems that the movie implies that it should go to a place called the Bank of the Dead for safekeeping.
I think that that's a final decision.
It officializes
yeah, I think it's an unusual circumstance in the end that he is able to remove Sophie's and he's only doing it because it's trading.
I assume that too, but I'm just curious why Christoph Waltz Sr. at no point prior to this dropped off his soul.
Well, I was giving that as a percent a reason why he did not do it, because maybe he didn't want to make the final decision.
I guess. So, like, it was right, like, yeah, that's sort of like you're unequivocally fucked at that point. And yeah. up until then, it's sort of like a threat hanging over your head that I could do this, right?
And he might, you know, as much as he made his son sign the contract, it's a different thing to be like, I'm gonna
actually do
ratify
it,
ratify it, right? Yes,
yeah, it's something that's not really dealt with very clearly in this movie,
right? A lot of stuff is explained very summarily and insufficiently,
right? So
as is this.
Basically, while this is going on, Christoph Waltz Jr. is like, "Dad, give me that copy of the contract that I signed back to me, so that you know you can't send my soul to the vault to the Bank of the Dead for all eternity." And while he has like sort of seemingly the upper hand, Paul realizes that he didn't find a way out of that nether space with all the doors. He created a way out.
Yep.
And they realize...
Well, he doesn't realize it.
Well, Sophie realizes
he is
this.
Dumb.
Yeah, Paul's a dummy. Sophie realizes that, like, oh, the bank is actually sort of right underneath you, technically, so you could just make a door into the Bank of the Dead, drop the soul off there, and this will all be over with.
Yep.
Paul does this. He goes down. He delivers the soul. And then he says, but also, I want an exchange. I want Sophie's soul back, because Sophie had signed a contract as part of her fast track on the job, mm-hmm. which would basically allow them to use her as a guinea pig so that they could sort of manipulate her. Like early on, Sophie says, I hate coffee, I hate licorice, I hate balloons. And then later in the movie, she's drinking coffee and she has a craving for licorice. And she's like, I think balloons are cool, which makes Paul go like, oh, what's going on here?
So this is like the big sign that the ultimate goal of the company is to... Basically,
of the company, well, Humphrey.
Yeah, of Humphrey.
To control...
Right. Humphrey basically has something called Operation Fine Print, which is all those sort of contracts that you don't really read and sign whenever you're, you know, getting a new streaming service or signing up for something. You just sort of click agree and don't read about it. He's basically been slipping in sort of fine print in there saying that we will own your soul for perpetuity. And so this is sort of his evil scheme that he wants to use the company for that no one else seems to be on board with, except for maybe Sam Neill, who's kind of subservient to him, but also doesn't seem to have his own goals, really. But anyway, while Paul is in the Bank of the Dead giving Christoph Waltz Jr.'s soul to the banker, he also says, now give me back Sophie's soul in exchange. So he does this, he goes back, he gives Sophie her soul back. It looks like everything's going to be fine between the two of them. Bad Christoph Waltz Jr. is sentenced to live in the nether space with all the doors forever. Sam Neill, for some reason, decides to be good, because his dad is like, don't worry, he's going to be a good kid from now on. And Sam Neill's just...
I fixed him right and right.
Yeah, and Sam Neill's just like, yes, daddy. And so, like, I guess he was just, like, spineless, and that was his kind of character trait, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, so it seems like everyone else in the company is like, hey, thank you, Paul and Sophie, for, you know, dealing with this problem and clearing things up with for us. Now we can go back to sort of, like, doing good for humanity secretly. Like, that's kind of what we were always sort of doing. So, Paul, you're going to have a job in the Lost and Found looking for things, and Sophie, you're going to sort of continue your fast track to dealing with the coincidence thing that you've been doing throughout the movie. And it also ends with Paul and Sophie sort of having a connection and holding hands, and Sophie stating that she has, you know, she still has feelings for Paul, and that's effectively where it ends.
Yeah, I will say that, this will lead into our first topic, but the way that the movie ends is probably light sequel bait.
Yes, it is.
Because kind of like throw Paul into this like junior position of Lost and Found, and they get a phone call.
Right. Yeah, that's the other end credits scene. There are two. There's like a mid credits scene with where they have gotten rid of, for whatever reason, Christoph Waltz Sr. is like, no one will use this portable door ever again, and like gives the towel to like a cleaning service.
Right,
and then you see and then you see like a maid in a hotel or something with a stack of towels, and she's standing outside a door holding one of the towels and goes, housekeeping, knock knock, which is what you have to say to make the towel, the door. The portable door also appears to be a towel much of the time, which I don't think we specifically said.
There's a tag on the towel that explains how to use the towel, but he cuts the tag off.
Right.
So that it...
Presumably, which feels like a very dumb thing to do. Like, all it's doing is saying that, like, you don't have the instructions. Why not just hide it?
Again,
why not set fire to it?
It's dumb, but he does it, and so that now it looks like a normal towel, essentially. So
right.
And so say, this is a fancy towel, use, say these words.
Right. And this is how it works. Say the word, like, hold it up, say knock knock, and then say where you want to go. But you see this housekeeper holding up the towel outside the door of someone's hotel room. She goes, housekeeping, knock knock, and you hear like the thump noise as the door appears.
Yeah.
Which is just like, oh no, now this lady has the towel. Like,
she had that instruction tag on
it. Or just like, what shenanigans will come up now? Is she going to accidentally let Christoph Waltz out? Like, who's to say?
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, it is lame sequel bait. And then the final end credit scene, which we didn't watch this time, it's just Paul in his office and the Lost and Found. He just like gets a phone call being like,
yeah.
Hey, I'm Paul in the Lost and Found office. What can I help you with? And that's it. Like, it's strange why that scene is even there, because it doesn't lend anything.
I was just going to say that I think probably the reason why they are... Because the thing is, they're very... They don't explain what the fuck is Paul's deal.
Right.
The whole time. But it's very clear that he's unique and special for some reason. First, like, his divining ability seems rare enough to be coveted or sought out specifically because they need him to find the door.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, like... He seems like an otherwise potato of a human.
Right, he's kind of a dope. So I guess the idea is that like he's easy to manipulate because
but his ability makes him valuable enough to hire just to find the door.
Right.
But then also he has this other power that seems unheard of to create doors.
Right.
And that's not explained at all, but I believe in the second and third books his like ability becomes like more apparent and is explained. So I think that they're probably setting that up for potential future movies.
I would think that probably
won't come, I'd imagine.
Well, I mean, who's to know? This movie came out last year, and it's also hard to track because this was not theatrically released in the US, but presumably was in the UK or Australia. So it's like, did it make enough internationally for them to think it's fine? I have no idea.
I mean, and I guess you'd probably have to call it something else, right? Because
there are sequels to the books
the
that all
are
have
not called the portable doors.
Right? Yeah, like the portable door part 2 or something. They just have different names. But like, I would also think that if that were the case, you would kind of maybe want the end credits scene with Paul in the office to focus on making a door. Like maybe you hear him like talk to someone on the phone and be like, "All right, I'm on it." And then he just goes like, and a door opens out of nowhere as to sort of just like ramp up the fact.
I don't know if
fact.
That's like the sum total of what he does. Right?
Yeah,
I think it's just part of his weird gifts of mind, like ability set. But let's cut into the book for a bit.
Yeah, right. Because we all know doors are not inherently portable, but what this book presupposes is
what if they were?
Yes.
This is an adaptation of a book. I tried to read the book. I gave up reading the book. The book is not compelling.
What's the name of the author? Do you have the name of the author?
Tim Holt,
okay.
So is it just sort of like
he's
too slow, too stodgy?
I had looked him up on Wikipedia, and this guy has done a fucking shit ton of books.
Yeah, he's quite a prolific writer, but... My like sort of pithy explanation is that it's like a worse Hitchhiker's Guide tone, but it's like I was trying to find words for why one was good and one's not, what the difference is, and I think it's to do with like I don't know like a point of view, where like in the beginning of The Portable Door, the book, he's sort of describing, or I don't know if it's him, it's
a narrator.
The narrator, it's a third person book, so like I don't know if we're specifically in Paul's mindset and we're hearing what Paul thinks of people, or if this is really more of an omniscient POV, but the book describes the appearance of all the people coming into interview and all the way that the like we don't know that they're magicians yet, but they're magicians in the room look, and how Sophie the girl looks. And like it's all like really like unsavory. Like, everyone is described in terms that are just, like, not great, and it just kind of paints this picture of, like, whoever's point of view this is, they seem to be a miserable person.
And they're, like, grossed out by these people.
Well, either they're grossed out, or they just...
Or they're, like, looking at the flaws, and, like, everyone...
All they can see
to them, like, everyone is an uggo.
To them, everyone's an uggo. Because, like, there's people described, like, one of them is described as, like, having, like, a shrunken little vacuum face with, like, pinprick eyes, and, like, one of... Sophie's introduced as, like, picking her nose and having a thin face. That's, like, the sum total of her description.
Yikes.
It doesn't paint the picture of somebody who you'd later...
Want to like.
Have a love interest in. I'm trying to think. One of them is described as, like, either a 70s tennis star or a pop star or something. It's, like, this weird... One of the reviews I read called it, like... I can't remember the term, the adjective
glib.
They used.
You said glib.
No, snark is the one. It was, like, unsurpassable amounts of snark that are just like it's just too much, like it just never ends. And it means that, like, you can never make, like, a real connection with anyone or anything
right.
in the story.
Because you're just being given reasons why this is just...
Yeah, it just puts a distance between you and the, and
yeah.
the story
and
the characters.
And then you can't connect to those characters.
Yeah, and so I like, Paul is depicted just, I would say, maybe more pathetically than he is in the movie. Sophie is even more unlikable. She's
well.
Just, like, constantly saying things like, I don't want you to talk to me, or, no, I'm sorry, I'm not a very... She actually says just flat out, like, sorry, I'm not a nice person. I'm going to ignore you now, like... She's just, like, horrible. She's a horrible person. So I got about, I would say, 20% through the book, I think, on Goodreads. I think Kindle said when I was like, I fucking quit. So I didn't get that far, but the I will say that we'd read, like, a couple synopses. We looked for some information. The broad strokes of some of the stories there is a door, there is a conspiracy, a company politics thing. But the details are pretty drastically different.
Okay.
There is, like, another space, and there's two dudes in it. I don't know who the two dudes are, but I know that in where I was at, he was dreaming about two dudes. The wizards are, like, more involved early on, where, like, sort of one at a time, it seems like they all come to introduce themselves to Paul and, like, take him out.
Here's my thing.
Casimir takes him out to lunch, but, like, Casimir's a Polish guy, and he's like, let's go to this weird Uzbek restaurant, and I'm gonna give you this weird Russian dish, and then... He's, like, shoveling, like, plates of rice into his mouth, like, just whole, like, he's, like, he eats, like, three meals in one sitting, and Paul's, like, barely finished one, and the guy's, like, you're barely eating. He's, like, it's, like, just a series of, like, very strange interactions with
yeah.
all these people, right? So they definitely have, I would say, more, they are introduced earlier and have more defined personalities, which are cartoonish compared
mm-hmm.
to the ones you get in the movie. But yeah, it's just, I the book was not for me, I would say. And also, neither of these things, it's just maybe worth bringing up, because I've heard it described or brought up in YA circles. Neither the book nor the movie give YA vibes to me.
So is the book, but is the book ostensibly supposed to be YA?
No!
Okay.
It doesn't give the YA at all to me.
Okay. So is it? It's like for an adult reader.
I would say so. I
okay.
mean, it's about a guy working at a company. It's like, who's...
I mean, I guess, yeah, I guess, like, the only weirdish thing, I think, for me where I guess you might get confused is because it is a young guy, like, straight out of college, so you might think that maybe it's supposed to be
even that, I don't think,
YA.
I don't
but...
think YA books... Well, they're more concerned with high school and college. I don't know
I guess
YA
that's
books
true.
Are about, like, people starting their careers.
That's,
yeah.
that's a good point.
I guess it just almost feels like maybe that because of that, perhaps the average adult reader might be less likely to like pick it up because it's about such a young person. I don't know. Like I'm not saying I would, but
I think
that there's like a weird
for
stigma.
Young adult people, maybe because
yeah.
there is no cussing and swearing and
yeah.
sex, but I don't think that it's targeted towards them.
I mean, again, then it seems like there's sort of a Hitchhiker's thing where Hitchhiker's is clearly not intended for younger readers, but like could be read
yeah.
by younger readers.
But I don't know that Hitchhiker's would be described as a YA.
No, I wouldn't either.
Well.
Yeah.
So, I don't know where this sort of association comes from, other than, like, it's appropriate to be read by people of that age.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the closest I would describe to it is, it's, like, it gives, like, Roald Dahl vibes.
Okay.
Where it's just, like, everything is slightly grotesque.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
okay.
people are kind of unpleasant a lot
yeah.
of
the time. And
the
narrator is somewhat coming from a miserable
yes.
place.
Yes.
Or at least a cynical...
But usually in Roald Dahl, there's, like, one person that's a shining beacon.
Right, there's some, like, and there's, yeah, there's sort of, like, a levity to it, I guess. Like,
yeah.
like a fun, which doesn't seem to be present
here. No, this
here.
Was not that fun. It was just, I just kind of got tired of this book pretty quickly, and I was not engaged, and I didn't care for any of the characters, so I stopped reading. Yeah, I saw the movie. The movie's more enjoyable, I will say that. The movie adds more of a whimsy
I would say
lacking.
Obviously, you know, I haven't read the book, but as far as movies go that we watch for this podcast, this was not bad.
No, it's sort of like, I don't know if effervescence is the word, but it's light.
Yeah.
It is light. This is like an almost 2-hour movie, but I do think it goes down pretty easy. You know, like it doesn't feel like it's 2 hours. Things mostly keep spinning along fairly well to the point that, you know, you don't feel horribly bored at any point in the movie.
What I do think is kind of interesting is then watching it, you're both recognizing that, right? Where you're like, wow, this is kind of better than maybe the average shit we've watched for
yeah.
this. But then on the other hand, that fact almost makes what it doesn't do well much more glaring because you're like, wow, you're so much closer to actually being a decent movie.
Right. I mean, there are some like aggressively, some huge missed opportunities that this movie does or things
yeah.
that it doesn't do very well.
Or decisions that are kind of hard to
yeah.
track.
So,
yeah.
you know, we definitely have that going on here as well. And like, I think I kind of like the idea, like the basic broad strokes of this, I feel like I kind of enjoy for this movie. You know, I like the idea that there is this corporation that uses magic for, like, sort of the most mundane reasons imaginable, you know, where it's just sort of like they don't really have an agenda of their own per se. Like, it's just sort of like a capitalist thing where it's just like, if you can afford to pay like $5 million to us, we can arrange a meet cute for you, or we can help you find like your long lost cousin or something.
They
do
big things because they also say they were part of splitting the atom
and the moon landing, yeah, and all that stuff. So I guess it does just sort of seem like, depending on how much you want to pay, they can arrange these things to happen for you.
It's sort of, which I actually found to be one of its more interesting and compelling ideas, because I sort of like this idea that not only, like, behind the scenes have these people been sort of bending luck and fortune in these very specific ways and moments, but I love that it's like, if you have enough money, you can literally buy the fate you want, the luck you want, and they have the power to create a coincidence or a happenstance that makes that happen.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting idea.
They aren't told if there's, like, ethics around it or anything.
Yes. No, that's true. The movie doesn't really go into any of that.
They vaguely suggest it with Rachel House's character, who mentions a couple times about the code of ethics that she's supposed to.
She said there's, like, a magician code of ethics, but, like, I'm not entirely clear what that's in relation to.
I think it's in relation to the work they're doing. My guess is it's sort of like, you know, when corporations will hire like a diversity and inclusion person to their board, but it's not really a serious addition to their board. I got the sense that she was their morality pet. She means it, but I think to Humphrey, for example,
He doesn't care.
Well, yeah. He just needs someone who makes it look like they care.
Yeah.
I think Humphrey Sr. did, but
Humphrey Jr. clearly is in this kind of for his own personal gain. I mean, I'm looking at this series right now just to see sort of like what the other ones are. One is called like May Contain Traces of Magic. You don't have to be evil to work here, but it helps. Things like that. And so like, I guess I do kind of get the vibes that are being ostensibly laid down here.
Yeah.
And like some of these just like looking at some of the descriptions, like some of the subplots or aspects of later books, and I don't know, like, maybe this is just a throwaway line, but like one I had read said something along the lines of like, there is some Canadian bank that pays the company to like make themselves into like a world superpower, to make Canada into like a world superpower, and like, because this is so against like the nature of what the universe is intended, math stops working. So like, I kind of like the idea that it's just like these weird sort of things where it's just like, no, Canada was never meant to be like a force of nature, and if you do, like, the universe just crumbles around it because that's so insane. Yeah. And so like, I think things like that could be fun, and maybe it's just because this movie is kind of a little bogged down in the little world building that it does do, that it sort of doesn't have enough of that kind of whimsy, or even the whimsy that it does choose to indulge in, I don't care about. Like, the movie's sort of weird infatuation with office supplies, like the idea that for whatever reason Humphrey Wells Jr. likes to turn the goblins into office supplies.
I didn't actually mind that so much. I kind of enjoyed that.
We're like gone so far off topic.
I know. Go ahead.
I keep trying to wait for a moment to interrupt.
No, do it.
Like, but you said the word, so let's actually talk about the world building.
The world building.
Good
there
and bad
it is.
About it in the movie.
Okay.
But on to your point about the office supplies, what I think it does well is set the tone, like not set the tone, but like set the scene, like that when he walks into the first day of the office and there's like a stapler on the ground.
Right.
And he's like, oh,
don't touch it. Like, walk around it.
Walk around it and acts like terrified of it. It is an effective introduction into this world of like, what the fuck is this place?
Yes.
The fact that the building is very Byzantine.
I agree.
And I also think it is one of the more effective times where it combines the weirdness of comedy, because it never stops being funny that people react to the sudden appearance of the stapler with fear, and then you also get this very like music sting whenever it happens.
Yeah,
I agree with that. I think my issue maybe stems more from the explanation of why everyone is so walking on pins and needles around these things, because they were goblins who were turned into office supplies. Like, it's almost one of those things where I don't want an explanation as to why everyone in the office is like so preoccupied with office supplies, but then you just find out at the end it's like, oh, because this was a goblin once and he turned it into a stapler.
It is. I still have questions about how they work. Again, they seem to operate under a sort of quantum mechanics where they cannot move
when observed. Yes.
So if you're looking at the stapler, it's on the ground and it is a goblin. There is a goblin there. But it seems to be able to move if you turn away.
Right, if you don't look at it, then you look back, it can move.
It can move,
right.
It could be somewhere else.
I'm kind of two minds about it. On the one hand, I agree that it would have been better if they'd never explained it, and this was just a place where people greet these moving office supplies with extreme terror. But on the other hand, I do kind of like this idea that the big baddies move is basically just to turn people into office supplies. That just seems...
I mean, I have questions about how and why that works, and if it, does it only work because they're goblins? Is it easier because they're goblins?
I would say those kinds of questions, while I appreciate where they're coming from, and I'm not trying to defend this movie per se, because I think they don't specify enough things, but I think what they're going for is a sort of don't question it kind of magical abstraction.
I think that this movie tries to hand wave too much away.
I would agree with that, because in a movie where, like, it's all about magic, and the movie, and the most, 90% of the movie is, like, we do incredibly minor, like, this lady's going to, like, flick her hand and a stone shifts just a little bit, and the guy falls into a fountain, and at the end... two old guys are, like, flinging lightning and firing
right.
each other and
mm-hmm.
turning waves of goblins into office supplies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, where... how many spell slots you got left?
That's
yeah.
a good point. That's
yeah.
a good point.
Like, what's your mana at? Do you need a
yes.
health potion?
So, like, the magic that we see kind of runs the gamut from more kind of, like...
Yeah, and also they imply that Elder Christoph Waltz has been... doesn't have need of food or water.
Right, like,
right.
he will never die in the
he
nether.
Can't die.
And the way he says it is like, and of course, me as a wizard will
like,
never die.
Yeah, I'll be here forever, you guys will
yeah,
be dead in a couple days,
a couple
and then I'll be
days.
Stuck with you.
I guess that was something that made me wonder, at what point do they just start calling Carpenter and Sophie wizards, because...
Well, I mean, are they, that's, I guess, like, they're
they?
Not wizards,
well, he
right?
says he's a great wizard.
Yeah.
So there might be a...
maybe there are tears.
Because, I mean, they clearly have magical powers.
Right, but,
yeah.
like, are you a wizard then at that point? Like, is that what a wizard is?
My bet is, in absence of explanation, that a great wizard is some sort of, like, demigod-esque figure that doesn't need food or water. But if you're just a wizard, like, if you just have
yeah.
a power... then you see a lot of
I don't
human
know.
Rules.
Yeah, I mean,
lie.
Again, this is the world building and where it's, it gets a little foggy. No,
right,
I don't
because, again, also, like, is this company designed to create stronger wizards? Like, is their goal in hiring these people to find people with the potential to be wizards? Or is it just, like, you are good at this one thing, so we want to slot you into doing this one thing for us?
I think it's
meant to draw people who have potential in.
Okay.
Again,
but, like, it's not like, this is not like a Hogwarts where they're like, we want to make you all wizards.
No.
It's like, we want to use your innate skill in this one area for this one area.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't know that it's, like, specifically we want to use your innate skill, but I think it's, like, they look for people who have skills, because they specifically force Paul into the interview.
Right.
By causing a bunch of calamities.
So
that
he misses another
interview.
Yeah.
But Sophie's a different story, I think, because Sophie kind of knew about the program.
Right.
And maybe was asked to apply.
Right. I mean, the impression I always kind of get throughout the movie is that Sophie is more obviously gifted than Paul
yeah.
in many
yeah.
respects, or has a more valuable gift, perhaps, than Paul might.
Yeah.
Right.
So again, the way that magic works isn't really fully established, but, like, typically you have two ways that magic works, where it's one is, like, you can learn a talent, and one of them is, like, you are born with a
right,
talent.
Right.
So I don't know how it works in this world.
Right.
Where it's possible that Sophie, that's all. She's being a seer is all she can do. She
right.
couldn't do what Paul does.
Right, and that's
she
like yeah, because like
that.
Similarly, is like the Countess only really good at this one thing, and
yeah.
couldn't do, like she couldn't throw lightning bolts at Christoph Waltz, but she can do, you know, her little coincidental magic and shit like that.
Yeah.
Like,
I guess,
like, this is, like, we talk about this so much with world building, but there's just such a fine line between under-explaining and, like, explaining just enough that you don't need to know anymore and
right.
that the balls keep rolling. And this movie really kind of errs on the side of not explaining anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, maybe this also kind of ties into the sort of glib, snarky tone of the novels, where it's almost just sort of, like, dismissive of it to the point that, like,
right.
guys, like, we're not going to get bogged down in this nonsense, am I right? Like, we got to keep the yucks coming with
which
all of this.
Can kind of undermine things, right? Because then it's sort of putting out there, like, we don't care about
right,
this.
Like, nothing really matters here,
yeah.
so, like, don't worry too much about it, but...
It kind of feels like not a total cheat cop-out, but a slightly deus ex machina at the end for Sophie to be like, Paul, you make doors.
Yes.
Yeah.
If 1,000% is. When they had him find that door inside the nether, I was like, of course. Of course this is what's going to happen. He's really good at looking, because he's Alexis good looking.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to find a door where no one else can. I mean, I thought that part was sort of corny. I just wish it was more... like, I expected that to happen. I just wish it was more interesting how we got to that point.
Yeah.
It just felt like they were putting in the requisite time in the nether before he got them out.
Nobody ever comments on it ever again. Sophie says that in her mind.
Mm-hmm.
Sophie says, oh, you make doors. And it's like, great. He makes
door.
A door. And nobody ever is like, holy shit, how the fuck did you do that?
Right.
Nobody, all these wizards.
Right.
Because they definitely are ready to tell her at the end, oh, Sophie, honey, Paul's not coming back.
Yeah.
He's stuck in the dead place.
Yeah.
And then he walks through
the door, and they're just like, hey, it's Paul.
Hey,
and no one's like, I'm sorry, what the fuck did you just do now? Like,
yeah.
And then they all kind of bent him and are like, so do we get him like a junior position somewhere? Where do you think that would be? Where do we put someone who's so good at looking?
I think that probably, again, they just don't say it, but like, in my mind, I don't think that any of these wizards have a fucking clue what Paul is able to do anymore. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think they ever expected him to be able to do those things. So he's sort of like an unknown factor.
Right, which again, also feels like if you want to throw in like some sort of end credits scene, maybe you have something like that where like it's a boardroom meeting and they're just like, we thought this kid was just like good at looking at maps on walls, but it turns out like there is some, you know, wild card that's been thrown into this or something. Like, it just goes so much to like the movie doesn't want to explain these sorts of things. And to a point, there are times when I think it does that kind of well. Like, I kind of like... I feel like the part I like best of this movie is kind of the beginning, maybe the first half hour or so, where it's just sort of, he's thrown into this new world and nothing is being explained to him. And like, everyone seems annoyed that when he asks questions about like, what's really going on here? They're all just sort of like fucking stop asking me questions, man. Like, just do your work. And so like, I kind of love the idea that like, he works for this large corporation that does something supernatural in some way, but no one wants to explain it to him. And they're just sort of annoyed by the fact that he's pestering them with all these questions. Like, I think that's kind of fun. I think the fact when you start throwing in like these sort of rules into the universe about the whole like, what is the nether, how do you get in and out of the nether, what is this contract, what do you do with the contract, why does he want the contract, it becomes sort of like, well, you can't just kind of be glib about like the mundanity of the world that you've created. Now you have to actually do some work and explain what these things are in order for the resolution to feel earned. And this movie doesn't really ever kind of go down that road in a good enough way.
And then it feels awkward because you're suddenly being asked to care about this shit because it's most directly relevant to the plot, but that's coming up in a world where all this other shit just hasn't mattered that much.
Right.
I do think some of the vibes though that you're describing are successful. Like, even aside from annoyance, I think like even when Rachel House's character comes up to him, she's a really good representation of like, she seems nice, but there's also something, there's a very malevolent vibe going on, and that's effectively mysterious.
Right.
It doesn't go anywhere.
Right, like the first scene where she talks to him in the hallway and her hair starts spelling out beware, you're just sort of like, oh, that's weird, and then you sort of start thinking like, why is her hair spelling out beware? Is her hair, you know, it's sort of like, is the hair acting of its own accord?
Right.
Is she doing this with her hair?
Is someone else doing this?
Right, and then it just sort of becomes like, well, is this because she can't outright say to him what's going on? Like, are there rules that prevent her from outright saying to him, Humphrey is evil, don't listen to him? Because she like kind of, and then the second half season she's like, you know, Paul, if you find it, I'm the one you come to.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of feels like no one is ever outright saying what's going on in this scenario. And it's one of those things where it just, you know, you would think if you were in her position, you would probably want to explain what is all happening here. And if she can't explain why it's happening, why can't she explain why it's happening? Is it just like Humphrey has ears everywhere? Like, I don't know what it is.
Which would have been easy enough to establish.
Yeah.
We're kind of getting into more story flaws.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good thing to get into specifically. But I want to talk about, on that note, Casimir is also a mysterious.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, Casimir is one of the other, like, board members.
His appearance is bizarre to me because he shows up in a dream, which is already kind of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Kind of
upsetting.
Yeah.
Feels upsetting. A little violent. Right. There's a lot of like weird kind of like body horror happening where Paul's legs start bending backwards.
Yeah,
he shows up
in his dreams to be like, Paul, I need to know why you were hired.
Yeah.
I'm gonna do weird dream.
Right, like what does Humphrey Wells see in you?
Yeah.
What does he want you to do? And Paul's like, I don't really know. Like, why are you asking me these things?
And he does know. It means
like, right, he's like bluffing.
So he dream tortures Paul until Paul says, but then weirdly after Paul says, oh, I need to find the portal door, Casimir sort of like switches really rapidly to like sharing intel on his part.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, you can't open the door. Like, there's only one way into the bank of the dead. But it's like, so wait, now you're like on his side? Like, what's the.
Right.
Like, why are you answering his questions if you're sort of torturing him for information?
Right, yeah, yeah. And obviously, like, we all know, like, it's dream torture, so, like, it doesn't count. But, like, nonetheless, Paul in the dream is clearly freaked out by all this happening. So, like, it is, like, a more gentle torture than, you know, actually breaking his bones or something. But nonetheless, like, it's a weird choice. It's a weird, like, go-between.
It's psychological.
Right. Yeah, between, like, psychological torture, and then it ends up with him being like, oh, well, now that you've told me, like, let's dish.
Yeah, I think let's go.
Right, let's, yeah. And then, but then also, like, Casimir never speaks to him again until the end of the movie. Casimir never really shows up and like talks to him again, so it just feels like I keep waiting for something he said to him to matter, or for Casimir to like pop up in another dream at some point and do something. And it just feels like everyone gets sort of like a weird intro scene with Paul, except for Miranda Otto, who has a little bit more to do. But Casimir and Rachel House just kind of get like one scene where they show off some sort of weird ability, and then like throughout you just kind of get them being like
Trust me, in the background, being like, ooh. I think, too, it's... We have this glib tone everywhere. And then what they try to do is they try to suggest a mystery through a series of scenes in which people just do weird things at him. And I think maybe in a movie that had gotten us to care about everything else, that would seem more mysterious and compelling. Well, but because we don't care about anything, we're just sort of like, why is all this weird shit happening?
I think specifically what's happening, rather than people doing weird things at him, is... I think the movie is trying to make it less obvious, or at least to Paul's perspective, make it seem unclear who is the correct, who's the good person.
Right.
Who is the good guy in this scenario? Because the very first person to sort of come clean, quote unquote, to him is Humphreys Jr.
Uh-huh.
And Humphreys Jr. is like, my dad was an evil, horrible, abusive man, and he made me sign a contract to give away my soul.
When I was a child or something.
When I was a child. What a horrible thing to do. I just want my soul back. Please find the portable door. And so that's the first reality he's operating under. Then, without being told any of that, two other wizards are like, hey, what the fuck are you doing here?
Right, like, yeah, like, what does Humphrey want for you here?
What are you looking for from Humphrey? And then Sophie gets told by Miranda Otto that Humphrey Jr. is kind of a sussy boy.
Right.
And there's this sort of internal war happening in the office.
Right, because Humphrey's dad and Sam Neill's dad at one point were in charge, and then they disappeared mysteriously.
And so they're like, we don't know what's going on, but we don't trust Dennis Tanner and Humphrey Jr. Keep an eye out. And then Sophie tells that to Paul, and Paul gets sort of, like, weird about it. And now he doesn't know who to believe. In the order that things happen, and also the way that they're being done, it's just sort of confusing, and it doesn't... So I think what they're trying to do is establish seeds of doubt of, like, who's
lying. Who can you trust, yeah.
Except that it's very obvious to the audience, and it should be pretty obvious to Paul.
But he a dummy. Do you think in the book, then, instead of Sam Neill's dad being turned into a stapler, he's the second guy in the Nether?
I don't know who the... I didn't get a summary detailed enough to tell me who the two guys in the Nether are. But I do know that the office supplies thing is in the... There might be the same thing with office supplies and goblins. I don't know.
Mm.
I would agree that, yeah, it's not done well, but I think that was the goal there, but it doesn't work that well, and it just makes... You are left with these questions that are reasonable questions of, like, why aren't the good wizards just being more forthright with Paul? And being like, hey, this is sussy, we don't want to...
Right, and you like, because you almost think that if Casimir can appear to him in his dreams, like, that's, like, a safe space where, like, theoretically, no one else should be able to sort of, like, eavesdrop on them in a dream.
Yeah.
So, like, why does Casimir have to show up and, like, start being like, what's going on here? Tell me, or I'll make your teeth fall out.
Yeah, and if you wanted... Likewise, if you wanted these things to happen in your movie, you could easily establish some way that they already think that Paul is compromised.
Yeah.
And so they have to resort to these methods, but they don't.
Right.
So it's if they don't have any reason to suspect that Paul is, like, fully drinking the Kool-Aid, which, you know, if they thought that he signed the same contract that Sophie did, maybe they can't trust him.
Right.
Maybe they think, like, his soul being manipulated, but they have no reason to think that. So you're just like, why don't you just fucking talk to him and ask him what's going on, and maybe tell him that your boy is evil, but we don't know.
Yeah, it's all for the purposes of plot obfuscation and, like, weird for the sake of weird more than anything else.
One of the other big, I think, logical flaws we had identified is why Humphreys... We talked about it a little bit earlier, why Mr. Humphrey Sr. has the contract.
Right.
And why the door... So the whole reason why the door is so important...
To Humphrey Jr.
The contract is in there because it's on the guy. Now...
Yes, Humphrey Sr. has the contract. Humphrey Jr. shoved him into the Nether.
Yeah.
But he lost the door when he shut him into the Nether in a way that's not really explain. Like, it almost seems like because the door has some mind of its own, maybe the door just, like, took off.
But already it's bizarre to me, because if your plan was lock your dad in the nether,
yeah,
wouldn't you want to get the contract first?
Yes, I agree. Because wouldn't that make a lot more sense?
Then if you want to get the contract out later, you have to contend with your great wizard dad.
Yeah.
Right.
And how are you going to get him get the contract without him getting out?
Yeah. I also love that Daddy Humphrey says something like, he tricked me with my baby dragon. It was a dumb trick and I should have seen it coming. Like, yeah, you should have. You are a dummy.
And so,
sorry, this is all just like that baby dragon thing, I kept waiting for that to matter in a way that I expected to come back at the end, like when they're fighting.
It's just sort of around at one
point. And like you see it briefly in the beginning, and then you see Paul kind of notices it running through the office, but then it might also be a mouse, or it turns into a mouse or something. And then like it never comes back in a real meaningful way. Like, you almost expect, like I said at the end when they're having the big battle, that like the baby dragon just pops up out of nowhere and it's like cute and adorable, but like, oh no, it shoots so much fire out, like some shit like that. But like, it's really just never coming back in a way that matters. But yeah, so there's a lot of suspicion going on, like confusion going on with that. The idea that, like you said, if he had the contract in the first place, he never gave it to the Bank of the Dead. Why did he never give it to the Bank of the Dead? Is the idea just that if you give it to the Bank of the Dead, like that's like the final blow? Like, that is, you know, once you deliver to the Bank of the Dead, it's like your kid is fucked and that's the end of it. Whereas if you just have this contract, you can kind of dangle it over his head and be like, now remember, don't betray me or I'll send this off to the Bank of the Dead. But it's just like, then why would you, I don't know, it feels like you need to keep it in a safe place or something. I don't know. It just, and again, like, what does it mean if it goes into the Bank of the Dead? Because when it goes into the Bank of the Dead, it doesn't kill him or anything. He's just like, he's not able to use magic anymore, which allows Humphrey Sr. to get the upper hand on him and force him into, like, kid clothes and send him into the nether.
Because he controls his soul now, which no matter how many times they tell you is okay, it still feels weirdly devil adjacent of like, and now we have a soul. Good.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, like, the whole thing, like we had said earlier, is just like, there is something that's a little, even though the movie kind of presents it as like, the movie first presents it as like, oh, my dad maybe signed over my soul to him if I ever betrayed him. Like, can you believe that? What an evil thing to do. And you as a viewer are kind of like, yeah, that is pretty evil to do. And then the dad shows up and he's like, but I was right to do it because I knew he was a shitty kid, and evil. I needed this like safety precaution. But you're still kind of like, well, is your son evil because you made him sign a piece of paper being like, Dad, I'm evil, take my soul if I do bad things to you? Like, that's just sort of like, this becomes this whole like exploration of like, well, what is evil? How do we become evil?
And the movie clearly wants us to feel very comfortable and good about the fact that Christoph Waltz Sr. is back in charge, like, oh, phew, finally.
Yeah.
When I think in this setup, they're probably realistically, they're both kind of assholes or villains. Yeah. Is the first time we hear about the Bank of the Dead when Casimir just says that, of course, you know, of course, you've heard the saying. So there's never a point at which they ever explain why the Bank of the Dead is needed in this situation, what their function is. We're just left to assume.
Right. And I mean, again, because like, you would think like, maybe, oh, if he gives the contract to the Bank of the Dead, like, does he die instantly? And now his soul is like trapped in, you know, in like a safety deposit box somewhere in the underworld. But like, no, he just like, when he gives his soul to the Bank of the Dead, he just kind of stops being able to use magic. Like, is that all it does? Like, it just prevents you from using magic? Does it ensnare you in some way? Like, I just don't understand what the fuck the Bank of the Dead means in this scenario.
So, here's my theory.
Mm-hmm.
So, if Sophie was the guinea pig to see how much control they could get over when someone signs their soul over,
mm-hmm.
I think whatever the Bank of the Dead does otherwise, they, like, officialize that function. So as soon as the Bank of the Dead has their hands on a contract that, let's say, would give me your soul,
mm-hmm.
not only would you, like, if I decide as the holder of your soul that you should not be able to practice magic, that's exactly what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if I decide you're going to eat licorice and love balloons and do this, that, and the other, that's what's going to happen. I think that whole plot line with Sophie is supposed to demonstrate, they don't call it out enough, they don't emphasize it enough, they don't explain or connect it enough, but I think what happened to her is what we see Senior due to Junior at the end. Okay. I don't think it's necessarily always magic goes away. I think it's, if you decide with this new influence you have over this person that is the truth, that it's going to be the truth.
I think that's as valid an explanation as one could come up with. So I have no qualms with that interpretation of it. The other thing that just occurred to me, though, when you were saying that, is we know that Humphrey Jr. is collecting souls for some sort of, like, purposes of control, I don't know, that he, I guess, has already given over to the Bank of the Dead. And then at the end, Christoph Waltz Sr. is like,
And of course, we've gotten all those souls back and we'll be giving them back to the... So, like, you can just go into the Bank of the Dead and, like, get them back. If you feel like if you sold, if you gave their soul to them initially, you can just go back and be like,
I guess it's,
have them back.
There's some kind of, like, void in the contract, or maybe you argue, like, well, I own this guy's soul now and he was evil. I don't know. We don't know any of the
fucking
rules.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I just don't, like, so much of this falls apart when it's looked at with, like, any modicum of scrutiny here that it's just, like, I get bogged down in this shit.
Doesn't the of the dead part of it even make it more confusing? Because you're like, so where does death enter into this?
Well, right, that's like the thing. It's like, you almost feel like when you give a soul to the Bank of the Dead, that person should, like, drop dead or something.
Right.
But it's just like, again, I don't know what's going on here. And because the movie has such sort of, like, an irreverent tone throughout, when it starts laying down stakes and rules, you're just sort of, what is this doing here? Yeah, like, why do we need this thing? And so, like, that I think is kind of, like, my biggest issue with the movie, is that the world building is all fun and games when it's just sort of being, like, snarky and irreverent and fun, but then whenever it starts to introduce actual stakes, it's just sort of like, whoa, God, I don't even know what you're trying to juggle here. I don't know.
There's one thing we have to talk about that we haven't covered.
What's that?
The absolutely insane decision that once Paul finds out that Sophie's will is being manipulated.
Okay. Oh my God! Right.
By the company that he takes the portable door, goes to not the office, the supermarket.
Right.
That was his first instinct.
Right.
Then he walks.
Goes back to the office.
Back to the office. Yes. When he has a magical door. And then the first thing is he does, to his credit, start to tell Sophie, hey, Sophie, there's really bad stuff happening. And then she's like, what is that? And he's like, oh, it's this magical door that goes anywhere we want. And she's like, holy fucking shit.
Let's use it.
Let's go on a field trip.
Yeah.
And then it just, like, cut to this montage. And it's like, they seem to spend days?
Right.
And it's like, they go to the beach.
Right, they're in the jungle.
The pyramids.
Yeah.
Right.
Some...
Easter Island, whatever.
Some mesa somewhere.
Yeah. And they're playing a kind of ill-fitting song.
Little bit pretty
bizarre
one,
song. We don't know how long, but a long montage of them doing stuff.
Right.
And then at the end of it, insanely, it's revealed that apparently at some point during that, he fucking did tell her she was being mind controlled.
Right, which is such an insane thing that she says. So, and she says something along the lines, before you realize this, she says something along the lines like, and because I feel like I haven't been myself lately or something. And you almost think that that's the movie teeing up Paul to be like, well, I can explain to you why. And then you reveal almost instantly, no, she does know why. She hasn't been consistently. Yeah. It's just like, he told her all this off camera. They continued to just sort of jaunt around through various places. And then at the end, all of a sudden she's like, boy, I guess I should be concerned that my soul is being manipulated.
You would think there has to, it's amazing that there's no time that they don't do it on camera, because there needs to be a scene where it's like, why the fuck didn't you tell me instantly?
Right.
Yeah. Well, but even all of that aside, just from the perspective of, if we're meant to care at the end about their end, about Crystal Waltz's endgame, to, like, harvest these souls and control people, then you'd think the one character that we know that has gone through that process would need screen time so that we can emotionally connect to why this is an issue. I mean, I know we get that academically, but you literally have one of your lead characters has gone through that process. Why wouldn't you give them the space on screen so that you can understand why it's bad and, you know, add some stakes?
Yeah.
I mean, what I was going to say is just, like, if you are supposed to be invested in them as a couple at all, like, why are you fobbing off so many of, like, the big defining moments of what essentially the relationship are to conversations that happened off camera? Like, that's just kind of what I don't get. Like, you're kind of meant to feel like you want these two together at the end, but the movie does so little legwork. Like, because Sophie's presented as, like, a very unpleasant character for much of the beginning of the movie, where she's kind of, like, arch toward Paul. She doesn't want to talk with him. Like, anytime he tries to be nice to her, she shuts him down immediately.
And it truly is like, oh, you have a magic door.
Right, then as soon as the door comes up, she's like, oh, now I'm interested.
Now we're pals. Yes.
Right, and it almost feels like there could be a version of this movie where Paul tells her, like, hey, you're being manipulated, and because she is being manipulated, she, like, can't even, like, grok that properly, where he's like, they're doing shit to your soul to, like, make you believe separate things. And she was like, yeah, sure, but what about this door thing that you're telling me about? That sounds like a real kick in the teeth. Let's try this thing out. And it almost feels like that should matter, but, like, it can't matter, because then you have to deal with the fact that, like, the relationship building between these two characters is being influenced by the fact that she's kind of effectively drugged throughout the entire relationship. So, like, I really don't know. Like, it feels like they had the portable door and they wanted to do, like, the Aladdin Whole New World thing with it all, where they, like, jaunt around and have lots of fun together. But, like, there's so many bigger things going on that we know about by that time that, like, we just can't enjoy this. It just feels like, I'm sorry, why are you, like, taking a moment to sort of, like, go swim in the ocean when you should be dealing with the bigger repercussions here? Like, maybe if it were restructured so we didn't know about about those things until after they had their fun little moments together, that could be something. But as it stands now, it's just sort of like, wait, you need to stop this and have an adult conversation at this point.
A couple points. Number one, it does seem like there was some sort of predestined or understood or divined like connection between the two of them, because I believe one of the wizards at some point is like is saying like, oh, by the way, how are you getting along with the new girl? Make sure that when you take her out, get her XYZ, don't get her X.
Yes, don't bring her when you've had licorice.
Yeah.
Right, Rachel like, House's, yeah.
People are talking to her as if like they're already dating.
Right.
Before they've even had a civil conversation.
Yeah.
So it seems like there's an understanding amongst the magically gifted that like, these two are just going
to
be together.
The other thing that I was thinking that when you said that reminded me, because it's Rachel House who's talking to Paul and says like if you want to like kiss her, don't have licorice right before, and if you want to get her a present, maybe get her a nice torch. I thought that would come back in someone when they're sneaking around using flashlights at the movie. Like at some point her flashlight dies at an inopportune moment, and it's because Rachel House knew that like she would need a better flashlight for this. Like it creates a problem because he didn't heed her advice earlier on to like buy her a flashlight as a present. And it feels like that's like such an easy thing for this movie to do, that for whatever reason now like buying a new torch just becomes like another like wacky throwaway line for Rachel House.
Yeah. And the other point is, so that yes, obviously the two problems with the scene are the first thing that you point out, but also my point is the plot should not stop for a montage of fun places.
Yeah, agreed.
When this revelation is, it's an insane cul-de-sac to go on.
Yeah.
Especially at that point.
At that point.
Right, and then like, to immediately like stop it and be like, but wow, what do we do about that now?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then, it's like the world-shattering revelation, fun montage, and then be like, oh, so let's deal with that.
Yeah, right. But remember that thing I said like five minutes ago? What about that?
There's like just a third thing I want to attach to that, which is the montage content visually, but then also with the song that's playing, it all feels so much more earnest than the rest of the movie. And I'm like, what? I feel like it's tonally kind of dissonant with the rest of the movie.
I would agree with that.
It's a strange needle drop, to
because
be fair.
I think that they're suddenly trying to make you care about the connection between
You're supposed to feel like, oh, this is a fun date for the two of them.
Yeah, and it's like, no.
Then it's like, you didn't want to maybe build up to that?
They've been pissy to each other the whole fucking movie.
Right. And now it does literally seem like, oh, you have a magic door? Now I'm interested.
Yeah.
Which, again, the movie does not seem to realize that's how it comes across.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
characters.
Let's start with Paul,
the linchpin of our universe.
Oh, yeah. Paul.
I mean, he's a dope.
I don't mind that he's a dope. I feel like, Chris, you had a little bit more problem with the fact. I don't mind that he's sort of like a passive antagonist who's kind of
protagonist.
Sorry, yes, of course. Passive protagonist who's just sort of like falling ass backwards into all this. Because again, if you look at something like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's the similar sort of thing there. So like, I think you can do that, and I think the actor who plays him does a pretty decent job of like seeming kind of likable while also being just sort of like this weird dope who kind of is like fumbling around for much of the movie.
I agree with that.
And so like I think it's a fine performance, and I think the character is handled relatively well, especially because like Lee, you had said in the books, he seems to be presented as like even more of a fucking idiot.
Yes. Or just pathetic, just like fucking horror, like useless. And I would say that Paul, what's the actor's name? Well, he's good. He's appearance and acting wise makes the character more endearing.
Yeah,
which you fucking need, because otherwise you're like, get it together, my guy.
Right? No, he just has sort of like a likable boyish quality that I think helps.
Yeah.
The actor's name is Patrick Gibson.
In the movie, you get the sense that he's like having a go of things.
Yeah.
Whereas in the book, it's very apparent through all of the writing that is roughly in his point of view that he's like terrified at every new thing that comes his way. And he's like, oh, not this. Or like, oh, I don't want to deal with this. Or, oh, a woman is talking to me. What do I say? Oh, this is my nightmare. Oh, God, I'm going to fail this. It's just like this horrible existence this person must lead.
No, my problem wasn't necessarily with him being a dope. It was just that I think the way that the dope plays with how Sophie exists as a character is not as satisfying.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a whole, like, you could have a whole conversation about their relationship and, like, what the movie is trying to do with it in general, certainly.
I just don't find them interesting.
Do you want to go on to Sophie at that point, the natural segue?
I guess.
I think, so I have not seen Sophie Wilde as the actor who plays Sophie, which I don't think I've seen her in anything else.
She was good and talked to
her. Right. And, like, so having not seen her in anything else, I have no, you know, knowledge of what she's like. So you saying that she's good and talk to me, like, I'm willing to give her the benefit of the doubt and assuming that she is a good actor. but like this fucking character.
We don't see it here.
No, I hate this. Like this is one of my least favorite like character archetypes. Like the coworker who's just sort of like such a dismissive pain in the ass to you right away. And it's like, don't talk to me. Like, what gave you permission to talk to me? I don't recall ever saying I want to talk to you. Like, you're like, hey, like let's go get drinks afterwards. Like, sorry, I won't be doing drinks afterward. Goodbye. Just sort of like,
yeah.
This character is immediately so unlikable that I don't get why he's even trying. And when she starts to show interest in him, I'm just sort of like, well, what is it? Literally because they're manipulating your soul and now like you're being weird. So like it's just like she goes from such like, you know, an uptight, unpleasant person to sort of being his friend and romantic interest, that you get whiplash so quickly.
You do.
So like I think there are different ways you could have done this character to sort of have kind of a similar sort of result at the end of the day. But the way this character is portrayed in the movie, just like from the get-go, I'm just kind of done with her.
The soul manipulation part where she's influenced to suddenly like these different things, I don't know if this was intentional, but it doesn't play only as suddenly I like these things. She seems looser.
It plays like
she seems like
right.
Seems like in a larger sense she's kind of cracked a bit, and it snaps back obviously eventually. But I couldn't tell if that was intentional or not. But I was just sort of like, wow, you do kind of seem maybe a little more cool.
Right. Yeah. Like when she sees licorice, she's just like, I want the licorice. Like, I gotta get it. And she, like, crams them all down her throat and, like, smiles and she has it all over her teeth.
Yeah.
Do you remember? It's like, you at least seem like a human here.
If maybe I'm manic.
Yeah.
Or, like, but yeah, when she's, like, holding the balloon. And...
Right. She's like, I love balloons now. And it's just sort of like, at least this is fun.
Oh, who else are we got? Let's talk about the two stars.
Yeah, Samuel. I mean, like, the actual names here.
Christoph
Waltz, who I think is great.
Samuel is... unbelievable.
Samuel is having like such a fun time in this movie, and I love his performance. I just love how like dismissive and jerky he is throughout the entire movie.
Making a buffet of the scenery.
He truly is.
He does a lot of shoulders forward, head tilted a little, but then always shouting.
Yeah, and when he says something like
what is the last name of
Carpenter?
Mr. Buck Carpenter.
Yeah, yeah. And
did I give you permission to be here?
Right, and the part where he's like says something about how like there are not words to describe what like Humphrey will do to you. Wait, gut. Impale. Ooh, they're flowing now. I think he's clear. He has like some of the best lines in the movie.
And I have to wonder if Sam Neill is like doing a little improv or not.
It reads that
way,
right?
I believe it. I've actually heard that when he can be quite a good improviser. So I would. I've read that before.
I had a conversation with him where he kept standing me.
It seems like there might be some ad-libbing happening, but it's the color he adds to that role is pretty good, and he really has no problem hamming it up. And
he's hamming it up in a great way. Like it's such a fun performance
to
watch.
Both him and Christoph Waltz are turning in just the right amount of scenery chewing to make their performances fun.
Christoph Waltz gives like two different neurotic performances.
Right. So it's fun. It's fun that we get like two like this movie goes from like a Christoph Waltz to like a Christoph ballroom dancing competition because you got two of them in here. And like you've got they're not performances that are maybe like as broadly funny as Sam Neill's, but like you do get a lot of good moments.
They are
like his two different collections of tics.
Yeah, right.
I mean, clearly when he's in the junior role, he is a little more kind of like heightened.
Yeah.
He's like this little hand wringing and
he does a lot more kind of like eager grins.
Right,
and
find the door.
Yes, and like senior's a little more sort of like beaten down older, but
Of course, as a great wizard, I will not die.
Yeah.
Your pops as well.
I'll be stuck with them.
Yeah. I also just wanted to give Sam Neill a shout out for, I thought he acted very well through So-So prosthetics.
Yes.
The goblin prosthetics are not the best that the Jim Henson Company has ever done.
Especially on his dad.
Yeah.
He's just sort of a green blob by the end.
Yeah,
just like...
I find, like, the goblins in this movie are aesthetically unappealing to me, and I don't care for them at all.
And not in an interesting way. They just look like shitty costumes.
Right, it's just, like, the most basic kind of, like, like TV, like, kids' TV show goblin kind of.
And then Rosie kind of looks, like, a little, reminded me somewhat of the Lady Gremlin from Gremlins 2.
Yes, she does look like
she has the giant lips and the giant
ridiculous
eyelashes.
Hair. I'll give that one credit. I feel like the only other thing kind of worth talking about, I guess, is maybe like the other three like wizard. Yeah. So you've got Miranda Otto as Countess Judy is her
Judy.
Name.
The one that Judy. Sophie talks to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's yeah. always wearing the same colors, same pattern.
She doesn't have she's kind of more of the sedate normal. She doesn't have much.
Right. She's kind of like no nonsense, but she feels a little more balanced than some of the other characters.
She definitely has a little bit of that, I mean, understandably from her name, an aristocratic air.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a solid performance. Yeah. You know, she doesn't get a whole lot to do with it, but like
I kind of wish we spent more time with her.
I mean, again, her and so Rachel House is Professor.
She's the one you get the most time with outside of.
She is. Yeah. And Rachel House is Professor Van Spee, and Chris Pang as Casimir Solowitz are the other two. All three of which I wish you spent more time with and got to do a little bit more. Because I think they're all pretty interesting characters, and like the one scene that you get of Van Spee and Casimir. Like, their one-scene moments are fun, but aside from that, you don't really get a whole lot to do with them.
Again, another shout-out for Rachel House's completely interesting face.
Yeah.
I mean, it almost didn't matter what lines she was saying. You're just like, God, you have quite a mask.
The face
like,
doing a lot of acting on itself.
But yeah, like, I mean, those characters are really interesting and cool. I think their performances are probably as well as you can expect for the narrow space that they're given to act within.
Yeah.
Metaphorically, I mean. But, yeah, they definitely left me wanting more because they were very fun side characters.
Yeah.
From my brief foray into the book, they seemed quite different from their book counterparts. Mm. Or at least Casimir was named, and he seems quite different from the one you get in the movie. And I like the one you get. I like the one you get in the movie more than the weirdo who's like shoveling food into his mother's restaurant enthusiastically over lunch. But I wish there was like more time spent on these characters.
I'll say music real quick. I think the score is mostly pretty fine for this movie. I like that it uses a lot of vocal, like choir work in the score, which I think is fun. There are moments where I think it's too sort of obviously telegraphed and kind of Mickey Mousing in terms of sneaking around and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's mostly kind of an interesting score for this sort of thing. It feels a little synthy at points, so I almost wonder if a lot of it was just that like a budgetary concern where they didn't really have the money to use a full orchestra, and maybe they sweetened it after the fact, or maybe the entire thing was done on synths. What do I know? But I think the score is fine. I didn't look up to see who the composer was, but I think it was some interesting work, more so than I thought might have been in a movie like this.
And it was a pretty good adventure, some score.
Yeah. Yeah, which almost just makes me think again, like, instead of using Little Bitty Pretty One, maybe just have him score that sequence and not just have it be, like, a pop song. Yeah. And not just remind me of the movie Matilda. Yeah. So anyway, that's about all I got, I guess, for that.
Yeah.
All right. Should we do fixes? Who wants to start?
I can start.
Ooh.
So here's the thing. So this is like a minor thing to get into. First of all, the fact that the portable door turns into a towel feels so much like a lift from Hitchhikers that it just sort of like upset me while watching it. And I was just sort of like also I think it doesn't really make sense to be a towel. If like one of the themes of this movie is like this large corporation uses magic, it should be something related to an office. So in my head, what it is, it should be like a Moleskine style notebook or something, like one of those little notebooks you can carry on your person. Something that would not look at all out of place if you saw it in a workplace. As opposed to a towel, where you would be like, that's weird, why a towel here? And then like look at, so I think kind of I like the idea of also because like a notebook naturally has the shape of a door with the front opening up too. I think that's just sort of like a little minor thing that I want to change. I think Sophie can be sort of aloof or awkward but less of an icy enigma. Maybe it's just the fact that she's like sort of socially inept and like it's not so much that she like doesn't want to talk to Paul, it's just that like she panics every time he tries to talk to her because like she was just not like an outgoing person or something like that. Or like there are any number of ways you can play this character as someone who is just bad at communicating with Paul without her being like dismissive and being like, who said you should talk to me? I'm watching videos. Don't talk to me now. That would like make you kind of at least like her a little more. And I know I'm very wary of like the whole character trait of a woman being like, she's clumsy. But like, I think if you made her just like a little more socially awkward and a little less uptight, it would sort of pay off in a better way. And also maybe fit the tone of the thing a little bit better. I don't know. I want more from the other higher ups of the company, which I already said, obviously, like Casimir Van Spee and Countess Judy, like these are characters who I think kind of pop and are kind of interesting in their brief moments in the movie, so I wish that they all had more to do here. The biggest takeaway I think I had with this, and maybe this is one of those things where it's like, well, now you're going against the books, to which I say, I don't fucking care, is that there should be less overt magic in this movie, which means I think no goblins whatsoever. There are going to be no goblins in this movie. No one is going to secretly be a goblin, none of that shit. And so
I think if you sort of play with the idea that magic is sort of like a vague science, almost in the sense that the Magicians does, and you have less of like, we're throwing colorful spheres at each other as a final end battle in this. It's just sort of like, it almost starts where it's like, you're not even describing accurately how they're causing these coincidences or these things to happen, where it almost sort of feels like you've just created a science to have this happen. Mm-hmm. And then maybe it could be sort of like, almost like how Game of Thrones did, where you sort of like gradually amp up the appearances of magic. If you were to do a sequel to this or something, like maybe goblins can show up in that one, or you just have more magic in that. But it starts off somewhere like sort of like a mundane use of magic, to the point that it almost doesn't even feel like you should be calling it magic, because right. It's so simplistic and used for such boring purposes. Like I said, I think the biggest takeaway from this, the thing that I like the most, is what I got from the beginning of this movie, the like mundane aspects of magic in this. And I know that I'm kind of cribbing from the Magicians in that a lot, but that's kind of why I think the magic should be more subtle, to the point that it almost doesn't even register as such. And like, I kind of love the idea about this company that was formed by magicians or sorcerers like hundreds of years ago, and this is how they exist under late capitalism, where it's yeah. like, it's like you were once doing sort of like maybe a more benevolent thing, where it's like, well, sure, like we still need money for exchange for goods and services, because that's just how it works, but like, we'll give you a love potion. Now it's more just sort of like, well, if you give us $5 million, maybe we can make your dumb son like find a girl who will like stand to look at
and
him,
have this
like that.
Beautiful story of how they met,
right? Yeah. And so it's just sort of like, maybe there was once an altruistic nature to this company, but at this point in the beginning it's become so bogged down by like capitalism and bureaucracy and red tape and all that shit, to the point that it's just sort of like almost comical in what it's being used for. And I think that would be more interesting for me personally.
Am I gonna ask?
Sure. I have two different ideas. Mm-hmm. And they're both kind of inspired by other things, but I was generally very taken with the idea of telling a story about just the mundane experience of working for a company in late capitalism, but then juxtaposing that with such a high fantasy magic world. So I would essentially... Have either of you seen or heard of the movie Clock Watchers?
I know of it, but I've never seen it.
It's like Lisa Kudrow, Parker Posey, Toni Collette, and they're all temps at this company where, like, they don't... It is a comedy, but it's also pretty melancholy and gets pretty dramatic. But they're just these temps floating around at a company. And eventually, like, there's a, like, stealing epidemic, and their friendship is tested. It's interesting. But I would want to do that, where it's just sort of talking about these low-level workers who maybe have the least amount of sight or awareness about, like, what the fuck this magical company is up to. I think in that situation, you can tell a pretty human story about these people becoming friends and kind of being, like, tested by what's going on around them, while still allowing for a lot of just unexplained absurdity to be happening around them. I think what this movie was going for at times was that trick in fiction where they don't stop and explain to you a thing, they just hope that it gets explained through like context in the dialogue or the way someone says something. I think they fail at that in this movie, but I think you could do that in this situation and it'd be very effective. The other movie I was thinking of that I think would potentially be a good template for this, because I was also attracted to this idea of like, we're clearly meant to believe that Christoph Waltz's father represented a more altruistic version of the company, right? Like, he's probably more into the, like, we'll create coincidences for people, yeah. We'll make love potions, because mm-hmm. I think we see that at one point. I wanted to maybe kind of follow that track and make this somewhat more like Toys, which I think, though it did not do everything wonderfully, had a sort of surreal otherworldliness that I think this movie could have used. And I think instead of it necessarily being a military person coming in to try to make military toys...
With his military plate.
It's more... I would think it's more like a human Elon Musk type who is just sort of a muggle who has been made aware of this other layer, this other world where wizards are kind of operating in this, simply because he has so much money, is able to basically do a hostile takeover and does not completely understand what they do there and why, but mainly just wants to bend it towards using the Operation Fine Print to suck up these souls and dictate to everyone what to buy so he can make a shitload of money.
I don't know if the details of this worked out, but I do want to keep like the portable door premise in there. I kind of want it to... So the biggest like connection I had to this movie when I first watched it was the video game Control, which is mm-hmm. like... The Federal Bureau of Control is, like, a fictional government agency, which is kind of like if X-Files was a whole secret government agency devoted to, like, paranormal or supernatural bullshit happening in the world. And, like, the idea is that your character goes in, and it's... In the game, you're going in after there's been, like, a sort of, like, ridiculous... The building's on lockdown, so it's unusual that you're even in there. And there's been some sort of disaster where everyone's, like, mostly dead or sort of stuck in a weird hypnosis state from, like,
some kind of event.
Altered event that happened. But you learn about the world, and, like, a lot of the stuff, like, really rang true, like... When they see a stapler in the hallway and they freak out, it reminded me of, like, how there's posters in Control, because it's very inspired by, like, it's a brutalist architecture building and all of the designs, everything a bit retro. There's, like, a retro cartoony poster of, like, is that really a stapler? Or is that an altered item? Watch out, guys. And it's, like, this... There's all this, like... It's all this warning. There's, like... Because there's warnings in the... Like, you're not supposed to... And, again, they say don't bring computers into the building. They don't work here. They're not allowed to bring cell phones or modern technology into the oldest house where the FBC is because it, like... fucks with the energy there, because it's like all of supernatural stuff is sort of powered by the collective unconscious, and it's too new to like really meld with the collective unconscious, so anything that's too new is just kind of like bad news to mix with that. So they work on all of this ancient weird old technology, so it looks like J.W. Wells in a lot of ways, because all of the computers are super old and there's a lot of typewriters and shit. So for me, that was like the vibe I wanted to kind of keep up. It's just this like weird antiquated agency where like horrible, disastrous, dangerous shit is happening, but to these people it's just like, ah, well, like, we can't go into this building today, there was a house shift and that link has collapsed, so like
what,
like that guy from research, he left, we don't know what happened to him, but it's redacted, so we'll never know. Like, it's just like the people just like vanish, and you're just not allowed to know why, because it's classified. And but like sometimes it's classified because knowing will make you go mad, or like
right.
cause the same thing to happen to you.
Knowledge not meant for humans.
Exactly. So I kind of wanted to keep that vibe up, but I like the idea of somebody stumbling in a similar way, where it's like sort of by accident. In the game, there's like an entity that sort of you connect with, so that, and it's part of it is in the oldest house, and you have a remnant connection with it that makes you allowed to enter. So I like the idea that there's maybe this special connection to the door artifact itself, where there's like a sentience to it, because the way that Paul at one point says in the movie, like, oh, it's not listening to us. And that's not addressed ever
right.
again. And I'm not sure if that's what the door is doing or not.
Right.
But I like maybe the idea that rather than, that maybe there is an outward aspect of, yes, on the surface it seems that the boss targeted him and hired him. But really what happened is some sort of unseen force wanted Paul at this company for reasons only it knows. And there's some sort of, like, arcane energy or arcane sentience there that maybe the building has unto itself, or that is tied to a special artifact that, like, wants Paul for a specific reason. And I like that maybe that's... It could be the door, and that's why, the door is calling to him specifically. So, I want to keep the Souls plot, because I think that's a solid plot for your story, is, like... getting hired to this company, being told you need to find the door, and the reason why you need to find the door is because it has some key MacGuffin. I don't know if I agree with the soul contract, the Bank of the Dead thing, so it might be something different, but there's something inside the door that you need to get the soul contract, terms and conditions, Operation Fine Print kicking off, that Humphrey Wells can't get until he finds the portable door. But the portable door has different plans in mind for Paul, but it can't communicate because it's a door. So it has to, like, find other ways to direct Paul to, like, figure out how to get this way out of the situation. And maybe it does have the dad trapped in there, but the dad just is, like, stuck in some other nether place that the door can maybe access, and he can hook Paul up with that. But, yeah, I kind of want it to be more about these artifacts having more of a significance or, like, an energy or a sentience to them, and the door specifically being somehow tied to Paul, or, like, needing or specifically Paul to be the one that is involved in this mystery to save the day.
Mm.
And that's all I got. Yeah, would you guys recommend this movie?
I don't know.
I think I might.
I think I might, too. I think it's pretty
easy to watch.
Like, yeah, there's definitely, like, there are definite issues with here, and the world building doesn't entirely make sense in some points, but... Like you said, it's an easy watch for a long movie. It doesn't really feel like a long movie.
No.
So, I don't know. I kind of enjoyed it. If by some freak chance there was a sequel, I would check out the sequel.
I would, too. I think it's telling that we all kind of saw how this could be better. And I think there is a certain level of, like, good that has to be for you to even invest and look that far. Mm. So, yeah, I think it's a... There are definitely worse ways you can spend 2 hours.
Yeah.
Come back at us in 2 weeks. Toots. In the meantime, facebook.com/whywatchpodcast. Yep. Find us on all your podcast services.
Yep, drappack.com is the website itself.
Do whatever you want to do with them.
Yeah.
Comment or don't. Yeah. I don't care.
All God may judge you, but his sins outnumber your own.
And on that note, bye!
Bye!